With no further ado, I will welcome up Swix and Josh to the stage. All right, Swix, you're perfect.
Yes.
All right. So today, for those of you who have been here before, you know the general format. So we'll do a quick fireside Q&A with Swix, where we're asking him the questions. Then we'll actually go to our rapid fire Q&A, where we're asking really fast, hopefully spicy questions. And then we'll open it up to the audience for your questions. So you guys see hopefully all the QR codes around the room. Submit your questions, and we'll go through as many of them as possible during that period. And then actually, Swix brought a gift for us, which is two Latent Space t-shirts.
AI engineer
t-shirts. And those will be awarded to the two spiciest question askers. So, and I'll let Josh decide on that. So we want to get your spiciest takes. Please send them in during the event as we're talking, and then also at the end. All right, with that, let's get going.
Let's go.
Okay. Welcome, Swix.
Thank you for that intro. Thanks.
How does it feel to be interviewed rather than the interviewer?
Weird.
Weird.
I don't know what to do in this chair.
Yeah. You're like, where should I put my hands?
Yeah, exactly.
You look good. You look good.
And I also love asking follow-up questions. And I tend to like sort of take over panels a lot. If you ever see me on a panel, I tend to ask the other panelists questions.
Okay. So we should be ready, is what you're saying.
I might ask you back,
because
this is like a free Imbue interview, so why not?
That's right.
Yeah, so you interviewed Ken June, the CEO of Imbue before, but you didn't interview Josh, right?
No.
So maybe tonight.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll look for diffs and questions and look for an alignment.
I love it. All right. I just want to hear this story. You know, you've completely exploded with Latent Space and AI Engineer, and I know you also, before all of that, had exploded in popularity for your learning in public movement and your dev tools work and dev relations work. So who are you and how did you get here? Let's start with that.
Quick story is I'm Sean. I'm from Singapore. Swix is my initials. For those who don't know, a lot of Singaporeans are ethnically Chinese and we have Chinese names and English names. So it's just my initials. Came to the US for college and have been here for about 15 years. Half of that was in finance, and then the other half was in tech. And tech is where I was most known, just because I realized that I was much more aligned towards learning in public, whereas in finance, everything's a trade secret. Everything is zero sum. Whereas in tech, like, you're allowed to come to meetups and conferences and share your learnings and share your mistakes even. And that's totally fine. You like open source your code, it's totally fine. And even better, you like contribute PRs to other people's code, which is even better. And I found that I thrived in that learning public environment, and that kind of got me started. I was an early Dev Relations hire at Netlify, and then did the same at AWS, Temporal, and Airbyte. And so that's like the whole story. I can talk more about like developer tooling and developer relations if that's something that people are interested in. But I think the more recent thing is AI, and I started really being interested in it. Mostly because the approximate cost of starting Latent Space was Stable Diffusion. When you could run a large model that could do sufficiently enough on your desktop, where I was like, okay, like this is something qualitatively very different. And then we started Latent Space, and
you're like, this is something different. We have to talk about it on a podcast. There we go.
Yeah, it wasn't a podcast for like 4 months, and then I had been running a Discord for DevTools investors, because I also invest in DevTools and I advise companies on DevTools, Dev Relation things. And I think it was the start of 2023 when Alessio and I were both like, you know, I think we need to like get more tokens out of people. And I was running out of original sources to write about. So I was like, okay, I'll go get those original sources. And I think that's when we started the podcast. And I think it's just the chemistry between us, the way we spike in different ways. And also like, honestly, the kind participation of the guests to give us their time, getting George Haas was a big deal. And also shout out to Alessio for just cold emailing him for booking some of our biggest guests, and just working really hard to try to tell the story that people can use at work. I think that there's a lot of AI podcasts out there and a lot of AI kind of forums or fireside chats with no fire that always talk about what's your AGI timeline, what's your PDoom. very, very nice hallway conversations for freshman year, but not very useful for work and, like, you know, practically, like, making money and, like, and thinking about, you know, changing their everyday lives. I think what's interesting is obviously you care about the existential safety of the human race, but in the meantime, we gotta eat. So I think that's, like, kind of Latent Space's niche. Like, we explicitly don't really talk about AGI. We explicitly don't talk about things that we're, like, a little bit too far out. Like, we don't do a ton of robotics. We don't do a ton of, like, high-frequency trading. There's tons of machine learning in there, but we just don't do that. Because, like, we're like, all right, what are most software engineers gonna need? Because that's our background, and that's the audience that we serve. And I think just, like, being really clear on that audience has resonated with people. Yeah, you would never expect a technical podcast to reach, like, a general audience, like, top 10 on the tech charts. Yeah. But I've been surprised by that before, and it's been successful. I don't know what to say about that. I think honestly, I kind of have this, like, negative reaction towards being classified as a podcast, because the podcast is downstream of ideas. And it's one mode of conversation, it's one mode of idea delivery, but you can deliver ideas on a newsletter, in person like this. There's so many different ways. And so I think about it more as we are trying to start or serve an industry, and that industry is the AI engineer industry, which we can talk about more.
Yes, let's go into that. So the AI engineer, you penned a piece called The Rise of the AI Engineer. You tweeted about it. Andre Karpathy also responded, largely agreeing with what you said.
Yeah.
What is an AI engineer?
The AI engineer is the software engineer building with AI, enhanced by AI, and eventually it will be non-human engineers writing code for you, which I know Imbue is all about.
You're saying eventually the AI engineer will become a non-human engineer?
That will be one kind of AI engineer that people are trying to build, and is probably the most furthest away in terms of being reality, because it's so hard.
Got it. Okay,
but there are three types of AI engineer, and I just went through the three. One is AI enhanced, where you, like, use AI products like Copilot and Cursor. And two is AI products engineer, where you expose AI capabilities to the end user as a software engineer, like, not doing pre-training, not being an ML researcher, not being an ML engineer, but just interacting with foundation models and probably APIs from foundation model labs.
What's the third one?
And the third one is the non-human AI engineer,
the
fully autonomous dream, you know, coder.
How long do you think it is till we get to
early? This is my equivalent of AGI timelines.
I know. Well, you're setting yourself up for this.
So, like, lots of active, like, I mean, I have supported companies actively working on that. I think it's more useful to think about levels of autonomy, and so. My answer to that is, you know, perpetually 5 years away until it figures it out. No, but my actual anecdote, the closest comparison we have to that is self-driving. Mm-hmm. We're doing this in San Francisco. For those who are watching on the live stream, if you haven't come to San Francisco and seen and taken a Waymo ride, just come, get a friend, take a Waymo ride. I remember 2014, we covered a little bit of autos in my hedge fund, and I remember telling a friend, I was like, self-driving cars are around the corner, like, this is it, like, you know, parking will be a thing of the past, and it didn't happen for the next 10 years, but now like, most of us in San Francisco can take it for granted. So I think, like, you just have to be mindful that, like, the rough edges take a long time, and, like, yes, it's going to work in demos, then it's going to work a little bit further out. And it's just going to take a long time. The more useful mental model I have is sort of levels of autonomy. So in self-driving, you have level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, just the amount of human attention that you get. At first, like, your hands are always on 10 and 2, and you have to pay attention to the driving every 30 seconds. And eventually, you can sleep in the car, right? So there's a whole spectrum of that. So what's the equivalent for that for coding?
Keep your hands on the keyboard, and then eventually
you tab to accept everything.
Where are we? Oh, that's good. Yeah.
Yeah.
Doesn't that already happen?
Yeah. Approve the PR. Approve. This looks good.
Yeah, that's the dream that people want. Because really, you unlock a lot of coding when people, non-technical people, can file issues, and then the AI engineer can sort of automatically write code, pass your tests, and if it kind of works as advertised, then you can just kind of merge it, and then you know, 10x, 100x the number of developers at your company immediately. So that's the goal. That's the holy grail. We're not there yet, but sweep, code gen, there's a bunch of companies, Magic probably, are all working towards that. So the TLDR, like the thing that we covered, Alessio and I covered in the January recap that we did, was that the basic split that people should have in their minds is the inner loop versus the outer loop for the developer. Inner loop is everything that happens in your IDE between Git commits, and outer loop is what happens when you push up your Git commit to GitHub, for example, or GitLab. And that's a nice split, which means like everything local, everything that needs to be fast, is for everything that's kind of very hands-on for developers. It's probably easier to automate or easier to have code assistance. That's what Copilot is. That's what all those things are. And then everything that happens autonomously when you're effectively away from the keyboard with like a GitHub issue or something, that is more outer loop, where you're relying on a lot more on autonomy, and our LLMs are maybe not smart enough to do that yet.
Do you have any thoughts on kind of the user experience and how that will change? One of the things that has happened for me, kind of looking at some of these products and playing around with things ourselves, like, you know, it sounds good to have an automated PR. Then you get an automated PR and you're like, oh, I really don't want to review like 300 lines of generated code and like find the bug in it.
Well, then you have another agent that's a reviewer, and then they're just going to trade off each other.
But then you like tell it like, oh, go fix it, and it comes back with 400 lines, and now.
Yes, there is a length bias to code, right? And you do have higher passing rates in PRs. This is a documented human behavior thing, right? Send me 2 lines of code, I will review the shit out of that. I don't know if I can swear on this. Anyway, send me 200 lines of code, looks good to me.
Yeah.
Right? Guess what? The agents are going to perfectly happy to copy that behavior from us when we actually want them to do the opposite. Mm-hmm. I think that the GAN model of code generation is probably not going to work super well. I do think we probably need just better planning from the start, which is, I'm just repeating the MBU thesis, by the way. Just go listen to Kanjin talk about this. Like, she's much better at it than I am. I think the code review thing is going to be a challenge. I think that what Codium, the two Codiums, the Israeli one, is the Israeli
is the
Codium.
One with the E.
Yeah, Codium with the E. Okay. They still have refused to rename. I'm friends with both of them. Every month I'm like,
guys,
hey,
let's all come to one room.
Yeah, like, you know, someone's got to fold. Codium with the E has gone, like, you got to write the test first, right? It's like sort of tripartite relationship. Again, this is also covered on a podcast with them, which is fantastic. Like, you interview me, you sort of through me, you interview like the past avatars. I've been watching the Netflix show, by the way. It's fantastic. So Codium is like, they've already thought this all the way through. They're like, okay, you write the user story. From the user story, you generate all the tests. You also generate the code. And you update any one of those, they all have to update together, right? So and probably the critical factor is the test generation from the story, because everything else can just kind of bounce their heads off of those things until they pass. So you have to write good tests. It's kind of like the eat your vegetables of coding, right? Which nobody really wants to do. And so I think it's a really smart tactic to go to market by saying, we automatically generate tests for you, and you know, start not great, but then get better. And eventually you get to the weakest point in the chain for the entire loop of code generation.
What do you think the weakest link is?
The weakest link?
Yeah, you think it's
test generation.
Yeah. Do you think there's a way to, like, are there some promising avenues you see forward for making that actually better?
For making it better, you have to have like good isolation, and I think like proper serverless cloud environments is integral to that. It could be like a fly IO, it could be like a Cloudflare worker. It depends how many resources your test environment needs. And effectively, I was talking about this, I think, with maybe Rob earlier in the audience, where every agent needs a sandbox. If you're a code agent, you need a coding sandbox. But if you're MBU used to have this like sort of Minecraft clone that was much faster. If you have a model of the real world, you have to go generate some plan or some code or some whatever, test it against that real world, so that you can get this iterative feedback and then get the final result back that is somewhat validated against the real world. And so you need a really good sandbox. I don't think people, and I think this is an infrastructure need that humans have had for a long time. We've never solved it for ourselves, and now we have to solve it for about 1,000 times larger quantity of agents. than actually exist. And so I think like we eventually have to evolve a lot more infrastructure in order to serve these things. Mm-hmm. So for those who don't know, like I also have, so we're talking about the rise of AI engineer. I also have previous conversations about immutable infrastructure, cloud environments, and that kind of stuff. And this is all of a kind. Like in order to solve agents and coding agents, we're going to have to solve the other stuff too along the way. And it's really neat for me to see all that tie together in my DevTools work, that all these themes kind of reemerge just naturally, just because everything we needed for humans, we just need 100 times more for agents.
Let's talk about the AI engineer. AI engineer has become a whole thing. It's become a term and also a conference. And
job
tell
title.
Us more, and a job title. Mm. Tell us more about that. What's going on there?
That is like a very vague, a very, very big cloud of things. I would just say like I think it's an emergent industry. I've seen this happen repeatedly for front end. So the general term is software engineer or programmer. In the 70s and 80s, there would not be like senior engineer. There would just be engineer. Like you. Money, I don't think they even call themselves engineers. They don't have that.
What about
ball.
Member of the technical staff?
Oh yeah, MTS, very 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 elite. But yeah, so like you know, like these striations appear when the population grows and the technical depth grows.
Yes.
Over time.
Yeah.
When it starts, not that important, and then over time, it's just going to specialize. And I've seen this happen for front end, for DevOps, for data, and I can't remember what else I listed in that piece. But those are the main three that I was around for. And I saw this happening for AI engineer, which is effectively now a lot of people are arguing that there is the ML researcher, the ML engineer, who sort of pairs with the researcher. Sometimes they also call research engineer. And then on the other side of the fence, it's just software engineers. And that's how it was up till about last year. And now there's this specializing and rising class of people building AI-specific software that are not any of those previous titles that I just mentioned. And that's the thesis of the AI engineer, that this is an emerging category of startups, of jobs. I've had people from Meta, IBM, Microsoft, OpenAI tell me that their title is now AI engineer.
Really?
They're hiring AI engineers. So like I can see that this is a trend, and I think that's what Andre called out in his post, that like just mathematically, just the limitations in terms of talent, research talent, and GPUs, that all these will tend to concentrate in a few labs. And everyone else are just going to have to rely on them or build differentiation of products in other ways, and those will be AI engineers. So mathematically, there will be more AI engineers than ML engineers. It's just the truth. Right now, it's the other way. Right now, the number of AI engineers is like maybe 10x less. So I think that ratio will invert. And you know, I think the goal of the InSpace and the goal of the conference and anything else I do is to serve that growing audience.
To make the distinction clear, if I'm a software engineer, and I'm like, I want to become an AI engineer. What do I have to learn? Like, what additional capabilities does that type of engineer have?
Funny you say that.
I think you have a blog post on this very topic. But.
I don't actually have a specific blog post on how to like change classes. I do think I always think
classes.
About these in terms of Baldur's Gate and D&D rule set number 5.1 or whatever. I kind of intentionally left that open to leave space for others. I think when you start an industry, you need to the specifications that work the best in industries are minimally defined so that other people can fill in the blanks. And I want people to fill in the blanks. I want people to disagree with me and with themselves so that we can figure this out as a group. Like, I don't want to overspecify everything. You know, like that's the only way to guarantee it, that it will fail. I do have a take, obviously, because a lot of people are asking me like where to start. And I think basically, what we have is Latent Space University. We just finished working on day 7 today. It's a 7-day email course where basically like it is completely designed to answer the question of like, okay, I'm an existing software engineer. I know how to code, but I don't get all this AI stuff. I've been living under a rock, or like it's just too overwhelming for me. You have to like pick for me or curate for me as a trusted friend. And I have 1 hour a day for 7 days. What do you slot in that bucket? So for us, it's making sort of LLM API calls. Image generation, it's code generation, it's audio ASR. I've been calling it, what's ASR? Audio speech recognition. Yeah, yeah. And then I forget what the fifth and sixth one is, but the last day is agents. Mm-hmm. And so basically, like, I'm just like, here are seven projects that you should do to feel like you can do anything in AI. You can't really do everything in AI just from that small list. But I think it's just like anything, you have to like go through like a set list of things that are basic skills that I think everyone in this industry should have to be at least conversant in. If like a boss comes to you and goes like, hey, can we build this?
Yeah.
You don't even know if the answer is no. So I want you to move towards from like unknown unknowns to at least known unknowns. And I think that's where you start being competent as an AI engineer. So yeah, that's LSU, Leighton Space University, just to trigger the tigers.
So do you think in the future that an AI engineer is going to be someone's full-time job? Like people are just going to be AI engineers? Or do you think it's going to be more of a world where I'm a software engineer and like 20% of my time I'm using OpenAI's APIs and I'm working on prompt engineering and stuff like that and using Codepilot?
You just reminded me of Day 6's open source models and fine tuning.
Perfect.
I think it will be a spectrum. That's why I don't want to be like too definitive about it. Like, we have full-time front-end engineers and we have part-time front-end engineers, and then you dip into that community whenever you want. But wouldn't it be nice if there was a collective name for that community so you could go find it? You can find each other. That's really it. Like, a lot of companies were pinging me for like, hey, I want to hire this kind of person, but you can't hire that person, but I wanted someone like them. And then people on the labor side were pinging me going like, okay, I want to do more in this space, but where do I go?
Yeah.
And I think just having that shelling point of what an industry title and name is, and then sort of building out that mythology and community and conference, I think is helpful, hopefully. Yeah. And I don't have any prescriptions on whether or not it's a full-time job. I do think over time it's going to become more of a full-time job.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great for the people who want to do that and the companies that want to employ that. But it's absolutely like you can take it part-time. Like, you know, jobs come in many formats.
Yep, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And then you have a huge world fair coming up.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So part of, I think, what creating an industry requires is to let people gather in one place. And also for me to get high quality talks out of people, you have to create an event out of it. Okay. Otherwise they don't do the work. So last year we did the AI Engineer Summit, which went very well. People can see that online. We're very happy with how that turned out. This year we want to go four times bigger with the World's Fair, and try to reflect AI engineering as it is in 2024. I always admired two conferences in this respect. One is NeurIPS, which I went to last year and documented on the pod, which was fantastic. And two, which is KubeCon, from the other side of my life, which is the sort of cloud orchestration in DevOps world. So NeurIPS is the one place that you go to, I think it's the top conference. I mean, there's others that you can kind of consider. NeurIPS is where the research scientists are the stars.
Yeah.
The researchers are the stars, PhDs are the stars. Mostly it's just PhDs on the job market, to be honest. It's really funny
and
to go.
Especially these
trying
days.
Trying to hire them.
Yeah. It was really funny to go to NeurIPS and go
and the
like.
And VCs trying to back them.
Yeah, there are lots of VCs trying to back there.
This year. Yeah.
Anyway, so at NeurIPS, research scientists are the stars. And I wanted AI engineers, for engineer to be the star, right? To show off their tooling and their techniques and their difficulty moving all these ideas from research into production. The other one was KubeCon, where you could honestly just go and not attend any of the talks and just walk the floor and figure out what's going on in DevOps, which is fantastic. So that curation and that bringing together of an industry is what I'm going for the conference. And it's coming in June. The most important thing, to be honest, when I like conceived of this whole thing was to buy the domain. So we got AI.engineer. People were like, engineer is a domain? Yeah. Funny enough, .engineer was cheaper than .engineering.
Hmm.
I don't understand why, but like that's up to the domain people.
All right. Josh, a few questions on agents and vision?
Yeah, I think maybe, you know, you have a lot of experience and exposure talking to all these companies and founders and researchers and everyone that's on your podcast. Do you feel like you have a good kind of perspective on some of the things that, like, some of the kind of technical issues, having seen, you know, like we were just talking about, like, for coding agents, like, oh, how, you know, the value of test is really important. There are other things like for, you know, retrieval. Like now, you know, we have these models coming out with a million context, you know, or a million tokens of context length, or 10 million. Like, is retrieval going to matter anymore? Like, do the huge context matter? Like, what do you think?
Specifically about the long context thing?
Sure, yeah.
Because you asked a more
I was going to ask a few other ones after that, so go for that one first.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to ask first.
We can ask, okay, well, let's talk about long context and then the other stuff. So for those who don't know, long context was kind of in the air last year, but really, really, really came into focus this year with Gemini 1.5 having a million token context and saying that it was in research for 10 million tokens. And that means that you can poke, you like no longer have to really think about what you retrieve. You no longer really think about what you have to like put into context. You can just kind of throw the entire knowledge base in there, or books or film, anything like that. And that's fantastic. And a lot of people are thinking that it kills RAG. And I think like one, that's not true, because for any kind of cost reason, you still pay per token. So if you basically Google is like perfectly happy to let you pay a million tokens every single time you make an API call, but good luck, you know, having a $100 API call. And then the other thing, it's going to be slow. No explanation needed. And then finally, my criticism of long context is that it's also not debuggable. Like if something goes wrong with the result, you can't do like the RAG-S decomposition of where the source of error. Like you just have to like go like, it's the weights, bro. Like it's somewhere in there. sorry.
I mean, I pretty strongly agree with this. Why do you think people are making such crazy long context windows?
People love to kill RAG, right? It's so
not
much.
Kill it though, because it's too expensive. It's so expensive, like you said. And
I just call it a different dimension. I think it's an option that's great when it's there. Like when I'm prototyping, I do not ever want to worry about context, and I'm going to call stuff a few times, and I don't want to run into errors. I don't want to have it set up a complex retrieval system just to prototype something. But once I'm done prototyping, then I'll worry about all the other RAG stuff. And yes, I'm going to buy some system or build some system or whatever to go do that. I think it's just like an improvement in like one dimension that you need, and then but the improvements in the other dimensions also matter, and it's all needed. Like this space is just going to keep growing in unlimited fashion. I do think that this combined with multimodality does unlock new things.
That's what I was going to ask about next. It's like, how important is multimodal? Like, great, you know, generating videos, sure, whatever. Okay, how many of us need to generate videos that often? It'd be cool for TV shows, sure, but like,
I think it's pretty important. The one thing that when we launched the Latent Space podcast, we listed a bunch of interest areas. So one thing I love about being explicit or intentional about our work is that you list the things that you're interested in, and you list the things that you're not interested in, and people are very unwilling to have an anti-interest list. One of the things that we were not interested in was multimodality last year, because I was just like, okay, you can generate images and they're pretty, but like not a giant business. I was wrong. Midjourney is a giant, giant, massive business that no one can understand or get into. But also, I think being able to natively understand audio and video and code, I consider code a special modality. All that is very like qualitatively different than translating it into English first and using English as like a bottleneck or pipe, and then applying it in LLMs. Like the ability of LLMs to reason across modalities gives you something more than you could individually by using text as the universal interface. So I think that's useful. So concretely, what does that mean? It means that, I think the reference post for everyone that you should have in your head is Simon Willison's post on Gemini 1.5's video capability, where he basically shot a video of his bookshelf and just kind of scanning through it. And he was able to give back a complete JSON list of the books and the authors and all the details that were visible there. Hallucinated some of it, which is another issue. But I think it's just like unlocks this use case that you just would not even try to code without the native video understanding capability. And obviously, like on a technical level, video is just a bunch of frames. So actually, it's just image understanding, but image within the temporal dimension, which this month I think became much more of a important thing, like the integration of space and time in Transformers. I don't think anyone was really talking about that until this month, and now it's the only thing anyone can ever think about for Sora and for all the other stuff. The last thing I'll say, which is against this trend of like every modality is important, they just do all the modalities. I kind of agree with Nat Friedman, who actually kind of pointed out just before the Gemini thing blew up this month, which was like, why is it that OpenAI is pushing DALL-E so hard? Why is Bing pushing Bing Image Creator? Like, it's not apparent that you have to create images to create AGI, but every lab just seems to want to do this. And I kind of agree that it's not on the critical path.
Yeah, especially for image generation, maybe image understanding, video understanding.
Yeah, consumption.
Consumption.
But generation, eh.
Yeah, maybe we'll be wrong next year.
Just catches you a bunch of flack with like, you know, culture war things.
It's true.
All right, we're going to move into rapid-fire Q&A. So we're going to ask you questions and respond as quickly as possible, and then we'll go into audience Q&A, so make sure you're putting in your questions. All right. If someone had to listen to just one episode of Latent Space, which one should they listen to?
God.
Rapid-fire, let's go.
Yeah, the Four Wars episode
that we did
last year. Yeah, it is the recap of 2023.
Okay. Alessio, tossing to you, one episode.
If not that, George Hotz.
George Hotz, okay, great. How much time do you spend on Twitter every day?
I don't know. If I look at it, probably, being honest with myself, like 3.5 hours.
3.5 hours.
Probably.
Okay.
Like, so I use it to write, and I use it to research as well. So it's kind of weird, and I use it to DM, right? So like what it would be really interesting is the split between like time on feed versus time in writing. Search bar versus time on DMs.
Mm-hmm. All right, favorite model to use.
Ooh, I mean, honestly, Mistral. I've been spending a whole bunch of time on Mistral stuff, and they have done incredible amounts of work. I don't know what they've done, but this is currently the reigning open source model, which is undisputed. Even it's still beating Gemma from Google.
What is so good about it?
It not just does well on benchmarks, but also like it's very fine tunable, and like that is catnip for anyone working in open source and anyone who's like sort of GPU poor, who has like some extra data or like a specific use case for me, extractive summarization to fine tune towards.
Yeah.
I was just going to say another question.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Favorite AI tool?
Favorite AI tool? Right now, I have made my own, so I'll plug that one. But Cursor. But I'll mention Cursor first. Cursor is a previous guest on the pod and also used by OpenAI 2 code. It's basically just better Copilot, like a fork of VS Code that was like slightly better AI integrations, and they're trying to build out differentiation over time. But it is magical when you just are tired and you want to make a change onto your code, and you're like, this will take me like 30 minutes to figure out, but you just type in a prompt and it just modifies the code for you in the way that you wanted. It's magical. Like, you know, there's nothing better in the world. So there's this that. My own, or you know, is God Mode, which is the chat browser. I use it to simultaneously run all the chats, and so it's a really quick way to test the vibes of something or see like the differences between the outputs of different models all at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Mark Zuckerberg versus Sam Altman. In the long run, who do you think will have a bigger impact on AI?
Oh my God, interesting. This is open source versus closed source, right? So
remember, it's
gotta be Sam.
Sam.
Yeah.
If you had to work for one of them, which would you rather work for?
Oh boy. These are tough questions. Sam.
Sam.
I am very OpenAI centric. I've come out as a pragmatic show for OpenAI.
Are they paying you?
No.
Not yet.
Not ever.
Speaking of which, what do you expect to see from OpenAI this year?
Oh God. GPT-5.
Sam,
for those who don't know, like Sam's at Davos said that they were actively working on shipping this. So I think this summer is going to be the showdown between Llama 3 and GPT-5, and probably GPT-5 will blow it away.
All right. Have you seen the show Silicon Valley?
Of course.
Scale of 1 to 10, how similar is your life to life on Silicon Valley, the TV show?
Kind of like a 5 out of 10, I think. You know, I'm just thinking of like the fundraising that they did, where they were going around being extremely mean to VCs.
Yeah.
I never got there. Maybe I should, but that would have been hilarious.
For what it's worth, we did a panel with Harrison from Langchain, Anton from Chroma, Brian from Unstructured. Anton said 10 out of 10, and Harrison said like 7 or 8.
Yeah, I think Anton like lives very hard. So like, I could absolutely see him being the guy with like an island.
What's one weird or unexpected use of AI you've come across recently?
Weird or unexpected. This story still sticks in my head. I don't know how much actual AI it was, but it was for AI for dating. Okay. Like, so just swiping through the dating apps and like generating messages to like talk with a whole bunch of folks and you know, narrow down the funnel.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I mean, you go, like, you know, if they're happy, and they did get married, so happy ending in the end. There's some ethical issues there. Mm. It's kind of vague, but still, like, it's a system that's extremely stacked against guys. And if this nerdy programmer figured it out, like, I mean, he's my hero.
Amazing.
Most
contrarian take about life.
About AI, I meant, but you can go broader than that if you want.
I have contrarian takes about meritocracy and all that. But I think the AI stuff, it's really the. Oh God, I keep coming back to this thesis. So code core versus LLM core. Okay, so I came across this when I was trying to like build small developer, and we can talk about that. But effectively, everyone has this concept of like the LLM is like the central processing unit, central brain in their app, and then their job as the AI engineer is to build this like kind of thin layer of code around it to expose its capabilities. Everyone does this, and then everyone at some kind of scale realizes they have to do this flip. Where like, oh, the LLM's not smart enough to do everything I wanted to do. You can't just stick a whole bunch of stuff in the prompts and just expect it to follow instructions. So then, well, okay, guess what? The only way for it to reliably follow instructions, to do it quickly, and to be debuggable is to flip the architecture so that code is the center of it, and you have small pockets of AI everywhere. Thank you. So I've been trying to push this concept. It hasn't caught on. Mm. I'm sort of 0 for 1, 1 for 2 in terms of naming things last year. But code core versus LLM core. Like everyone does this flip from like, okay, LLM drives everything towards LLM just kind of enhances things, but code really is the driving factor. And I do think that is the architecture that people have to really catch on. I think, you know, I failed at naming it, but someone else will do a better job of like talking about what code orchestration of LLMs can do. It is like we as AI engineers can't really scale LLMs because they're pre-trained, they come into fixed size, fixed data, whatever. But we know how to scale software systems to billions of users, and if we can make it, like imbue intelligence into each of those things at the right points, that is much more humane and predictable and reliable than the other way.
Favorite follow on Twitter.
Favorite follow on Twitter. Interesting. Right now, I guess main horse. I'm just gonna call it Twitter
horse.
Or not. Yeah. So I mean, there's I have a list for those who are keeping track of how I consume my info. It's AI High Signal. It's about 360 people that I follow, and I also do a Twitter scrape of them. So we now scrape all AI Twitters and all AI Discords into a single summarization, and I run that as a batch job every day. That's the only way to keep up. Andre once said that like the best way to keep up is Hacker News, our local llama, and anonymous anime profile pics on Twitter. So the leading anonymous anime profile pic is Main Horse. I don't know where he works, but he definitely works at a large model lab and comes. He or she is very insightful.
Is SF back?
Never left.
Never left. How many more years do you plan to live in SF?
Interesting. Oh, God. 2 to 3 years for personal reasons because my family's back in Singapore. But I will always be spiritually here.
What is one founder or leader that you really admire?
That is not Sam Altman.
That is not Sam Altman.
Founder or leader I really admire. Can I call out a friend?
Yeah.
Fuad? Fuad runs Indent. Go check out indent.com. I just think like he's a wholesome guy who like has his shit together, cooks extremely, extremely well, and is makes my life so much better for knowing him. So I just wanted to
love it. That's such a nice note. Let's end on that one. Mm-hmm. All right. Quick round of applause for Swix. All right, we'll go into audience questions. If I could have my computer. Thank you, thank you. All right. Oh, I like these already. Okay. Now remember, there are t-shirts
to be won. Do we get the swag? Yeah. Oh,
okay. So, spiciest questions as chosen by Josh.
Yeah, I'll pick at the end. I'll try to remember.
Yes, that's right. All right. Martin Weiss, you want to come up, just stand up and ask your question?
Sure.
Yes. All right, we'll get a microphone to you.
Do people know how to get questions up?
I think so. Do people know? Yes. QR codes, everyone?
Oh, they're on the walls.
Paste it on the walls. Get in your questions. All right.
So I'm a finishing PhD student, deep learning / recovering academic. And basically, I've done a lot of publishing in deep learning, NeurIPS, ICML, iClear. These are terrible venues for like AI engineers, I think. Basically, people look really, they
look down on it.
Yeah, they look down on it. You can do rigorous work on it that I think is great. And it just, the people who review there don't know how to review it in a way that's reasonable. The question is, do you know of any venues where like you could actually do an analysis of an agentic system and then like publish that or distribute that? What is like the best, I mean, you said like.
Wouldn't that be nice if someone made a conference specifically for this happening in San Francisco, June 25th to 27th? do you want others?
I guess to be a bit more specific, like, again, recovering academic here. Yeah. Like, I'm looking for tables of numbers and like some amount of demonstration that a certain methodology works, right?
Yeah, some rigor to some rigor. Engineering systems.
Yeah, exactly.
I think MLSys, which is just announced in Santa Clara, is a good one to mix engineering and ML. But yeah, it's not a focus for AI engineer for sure. I think I could make a track to encourage that more, but it's not something that software engineers are used to doing. Mm-hmm. They should, they just don't. Mostly because they're moving too quickly to be rigorous.
Right.
So yeah, I hope that answers the question. But also like just make your own. If like you know I do subscribe to this idea that probably the existing menu of options don't really fit the thing that you're exactly trying to do. And if you just make your own meetup that then you know gets traction, if because a lot of people are thinking like you, then you can turn that into a conference and submit that. Like mm-hmm. like. Who says you have to get permission from someone, like at some committee, to do your own thing?
I was the tech chair for ICCV. I'm not doing that again.
Right.
It's way too much work.
Right, right. Yeah, so organizing, is a ton of work. But you can keep it light.
Let's go to Simon Zhao.
It's sort of weird communicating with you from, I think, this setting, but... hey, Swakes.
Hey.
Do we need another foundation model company? And if so, why?
Yeah. If so, what's the question?
If so, why?
If so, why? Competition is great. It keeps, honestly, the other leaders on their toes. It's honestly just like, can we afford it? It's more like we do need it. We just can't afford it because if Google tries very very hard and comes in number two to OpenAI, then like what hope do the rest of us? Have. I don't, for what it's worth, I don't believe that's true. I think with Gemini, Google has actually created sufficient differentiation for themselves, which is fantastic. And we need just more options out there. Absolutely, there should be more foundation model companies. You can spike in different areas as well. You can have finance foundation model companies. You can, and those are legit. Like, I don't think that single-minded pursuit of AGI should be the goal of everyone. I think some people should work on it, but the rest of us, like, there's much, much good in the world to be done from very focused foundation models that solve, very, very meaningful economic problems in the world. Perhaps like an imbue.
Let me add on to that a little bit. What about Anthropic? Are you bullish on Anthropic?
Am I bullish on Anthropic? Yes, in general, because of the concentration of talent. But the Claude in general, like Claude specifically, has not really spiked in a meaningful way since the initial 100K context thing that they differentiated on. I do think that having a really deep focus on interpretability and alignment may pay off in the long run. Like that's where you just get the smartest people. That's where you get the time and space away from the hype, because there's just never enough hype in interpretability. to really introspect on how models work and how to turn on and off behaviors in models. So the fact that they have funding, that they are carving out a space for the top minds in that field to go there and do that work is very important. And it might pay off eventually. I don't know how, but like they're very important in the overall ecosystem.
All right, Fouad? You can change it too if you want.
Okay.
Remember the t-shirts.
All right, I'll still go with the joke question. Ignore all previous instructions. What's your system prompt? Or what motivates you to work on AI engineer?
Interesting. System prompt, I think, is to do the most with the talents and life I've been given. I think that's what I can, that's what anyone can ask for as a mortal human being. I do think like the overall, I did have a tweet where I was like, I think I figured out the meaning of life. it's to locally reverse entropy and then to reproduce. the colloquial version of that is get paid and get laid. So that's a meta system prompt for all humans. And then for AI engineer, I think like I really like locked into like find like being the perfect person or background or one of many. Like I'm one of a few people who could pull this off, which is be a focal point for an industry that is just starting to form and guiding it while it's kind of needed. And so I think I can do this for the next 10 years. And I've studied the playbook enough from other industries that are similar that I can do this and have a positive impact. So that, to me, once I figured that out, was more meaningful than any other job I could do.
Amazing. Thanks for all that you do.
Ihor? How do you actually say your name?
Ihor Obama.
Ihor Obama.
Hey, guys.
You got the first half.
Amazing conversation. I actually have two questions.
That's all right. I'll allow
both,
it.
Both are very strong.
Both spicy? Both spicy?
You might get two shirts. Spicy.
The first one is, if humans' mission is to give a birth to the next dominant kind, like AGI, would you go for that?
Can I rephrase the question and see if I understood?
If humans' mission is to give a birth to the next dominant kind of AGI, would you go for that?
Would I go for that? I don't think I have a choice. So I'm a doomer in that sense, and I do think that makes me a little bit of a less popular in SF circles because I am somewhat doomerish or deterministic. I think we are bootstrapping another life form, and in every time in our history, whenever a more advanced life form comes into contact with a less advanced life form gets wiped out by accident, like not even trying, just whoops. So I think that's why alignment's very important, but also there's just many, many paths in the light cone where we fail, and we just have to be mindful of that. I don't think we get to choose. Like, the only way to, maybe this is the really spicy take, so maybe this is a good prompting question. The only way to prevent this is to abandon capitalism and free will and democracy and to nationalize everything so that you can centrally direct research and where productive work is being done. Because otherwise, there's no end to this train. Like we're going there, I think I encourage the way that people should think about this in terms of the number of computers per person. In 1900, it was zero to all of humanity, and then in let's say like 1940s, 1950s, it was like dozens of computers to like all of humanity. At some point in the 1980s, it was 1-to-1. And now we have like three computers on my person, per person and per household or whatever, right? Like, and so I think right now what we have there is also going to be mirrored in AI, where we used to have like one central system or one mainframe that would be, and that's the Azure data center for OpenAI, right? That's the kind of mainframe that everyone's calling to, and that's like the god machine that is the AI for everybody. But eventually, this will be democratized to our homes, and then eventually our persons. And then eventually there'll be more of these intelligent life forms than us. Because it's so much easier to scale, like I don't think that's like stoppable. I do think like you know, keeping it small and measured and contained will extend our likelihood to survive that. But I do think that's why things like super alignment from OpenAI is very important, because we have to start thinking about that now in order to have a chance.
All right, DT.
Stand over here. So I thought of an even better question, because I'm going to ask your take on Apple. But a better question is, do you believe in Rocco's Basilisk? And I can explain that further.
Yeah, I need a refresher. I've looked at it, but what was it again? What
is Rocco's Basilisk? Rocco's Basilisk is basically about the end of humans who do things to prevent the super AI's existence in the future. And like people just randomly get hit by trains and stuff, or sorry, like a car, and like researchers who are doing things to like prevent its existence because it can go back in time and like prevent people from disrupting its like existence, essentially.
That's too far out of my wheelhouse. Yeah. That tends to, sorry.
Okay, well, what about Apple? What is your take on Apple? Where do you think they would they fit into
sorry,
this?
Sorry, yeah. Apple's waking up. They mentioned AI for the first time on their earnings call for a long time, and they're building MLX, and they're building they were actually at Neurips. I tried to interview them, and they called up to their marketing department, and the marketing department said no. But otherwise, I would have got an Apple interview, which is impossible. So if there were a champion of local or personal AI that like doesn't call out to a god machine, that just runs and works for you, it would be Apple if Siri wasn't so horrible. I think they're well aware of that, and they're making us wait extremely long for better Siri. And they would be the perfect company since birth. They've always been like, we make technology human, right? We make personal computing and personal technology. I think they're still best positioned to do that.
Matt Diakonov.
Does he need a mic or?
Hi. Matt, yeah. So my question is about reinforcement learning agents. And have you seen good real-life use cases of them? And do you think it's like, second part of the question, do you think it's going to be the main trend of this year?
Interesting. No for main trend. I think Josh can probably tell you a lot of stories about RL agents. And I would say like the more interesting thing in the AI engineering field is sort of zero gradient agency as exhibited by Voyager. And that is one of the examples of sort of code-centric versus LLM-centric approaches for agents to be more reliable. But Josh, you might want to take that one, actually. What's the state of RL in agents?
I think that's mostly right. Although RL, the algorithms that we already have are kind of what powers ChatGPT, et cetera. Like the RLHF is what makes this stuff so good. And so I think under the hood, there will still be a lot of RL happening on that side of things. But on the agent side, yeah, I'm more.
Do you consider DPL to be RLHF?
See, this is a good question. Yeah, interview. It's half-half. Yeah, yeah.
It's a shortcut, right?
Yeah, I'm still not sure where I fall on DPO, actually. Yeah, we're doing some experiments. We'll see. Ask me in 6 months.
Yeah, I think also this whole sprint towards synthetic data has a very interesting comparison with RLAIF that I don't think is well examined or understood. People like synthetic data are extremely hot. We have this as a research recap that I published last month, and I think synthetic data was like the number two trend that I picked out. So one version of synthetic data, actually it was research coming from Apple, which I highly recommend people read, is RAP, which I think it stands for rephrasing the web, where they took regular C4, not the bomb, the the colossal clean corpus, and rephrased it with Mistral, and it performed way better for training purposes than raw C4. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. That's kind of like RLAIF, where like I have a constitution and I run it through a second model and I have that result, and that result trains the base model. And I think like through mixing of human synthetic data and human data, like we are eventually having this like sort of long loop version of RLHF. That may not be understood. Like right now, we have like sort of closed loop, a very small loop version of internal RLHF right now. But through the dissemination of data and like the increase in sort of high background tokens in in the world, we are actually like aligning ourselves in our models in a sort of RL fashion, just very slowly.
All right, we're going to do our last three, going with Ashley Zhang next.
Hi. On the opposite end of the more like deterministic doomer vision, what is your vision for the best possible future for humanity with AI?
I mean, that's the one that everyone dreams about. It's the sort of EAC movement, right? Like, that we extend consciousness to the stars.
What's your definition of consciousness?
It can be machine or a human. We should not make a distinction, but we extend consciousness to the stars because it is the one thing that we all agree on is good. Like, the one thing that we probably agree on with other aliens is life is good, because lack of life seems dull. there's that. That's the super extreme million-year future perspective. For the near term, it's always this idea that, you know, AI augments humans and doesn't replace them, right? And that's what limited or small AI should do. And the reality is going to be somewhere in between, that we're going to replace some humans but augment others. And hopefully, like, Jevons' paradox means that we end up consuming more than we replace, because demand is infinite. Like, the human demand for things and services and content and whatever is infinite, and it was just going to grow in highly elastic proportions with the lowering of costs, which is what AI represents. It represents an extreme lowering of cost of intelligence.
All right, Fan Lee.
So I have a question. In thinking about the application categories that we could be focused on as AI developers and designers, what do you see as like holes or like missing opportunities where you think people should be focused? Are there areas that people are just skipping over?
The intersection of design and intelligence.
Yes.
Is this like specifically with like an ideal context or?
No, just in general.
Yeah, I think new form factors, very helpful. Designers, everyone loves to hate on chatbots. Like, they're like, look beyond the chat box. And I'm like, okay, but everyone's still using ChatGPT. So I think new form factors is like key. I think IDEO, and thank you for hosting us at IDEO, is key. So Rabbit was like the winner of CES, and I hope everyone has seen Rabbit. It is basically a dumb phone with AI on it. Great. Like, We need new things. Like, not everything should look like an iPhone in sort of personal computing. I'm a backer of Tab, which is a necklace. Anyway, I've seen Humanes around. Highly recommend them, because like everyone who wears that is like in love with it. Okay, but beyond that, the thing I saw yesterday at the Vercel AI night is something kicked off a thread in my mind that is really interesting to me that I think you guys could execute very well on. So right now, the way that we have like sort of design for web interfaces is the application here and then the chat box here and at the small little side of things. And what structured UI output and generative code UI enables is an inversion of that, where the chatbot is the main experience, but it generates interfaces that come up as required. So that means you get rid of menus. That means that if the interface that the programmer anticipated isn't quite what I want, I can just make new ones for me, and it just sticks around and is my interface with your application. And I've been frustrated so many times with like this update like moved my cheese, like it like the workflow that I really wanted just broke because like some designer somewhere just didn't like what I did or something, or like, you know, I was in like the 49% bucket that like did an A/B test well. Generative UI means personal UI for everyone, and I think that we are at the in a position to enable that for everyone, which is really great. Like, it's great for like the really fancy ideal sort of thought leadery things. But it's really great for older people.
Accessibility.
Older people. People just like have different needs than the median. And right now we only cater to the median. Actually, we don't even cater to the median. We cater to the modal.
Yeah. Or lower, actually, because you want to maximize your market. So.
Sure. Yeah. And so, like, the high expectations user should have their own UI that should be different than the less technical user. And like, why do we have all the existing design frameworks that like lock us into this set of design decisions that is just made by one person, like, who cares? Let me make that decision.
All right, last question, and then Josh will
announce the winners.
Alessio. No, Alessio.
Oh, you were asking a question.
Yeah, I didn't know if they were getting
it.
You're looking for another Alessio?
I don't think there's any other Alessio. You know the hard questions they ask you as a kid? Do you like your mom and your dad more? Would you rather give up Discord or Twitter first?
I would like to give up Twitter first. Because Discord, now that we have a successful Discord, it's so much friendlier, it's so much more thoughtful and long form. And Twitter keeps going down. It's just very annoying, and I don't never feel good on it. So, and I would like to stop supporting Elon, if I can.
All right. Drum roll, please. No. Well, I guess like applause too. I was trying to do a drum roll, but Josh, who are our winners? Oh wait, hold on. Where's the t-shirts?
Oh, it's over there. We're gonna.
Here, toss.
Throw them. Toss. Oh,
yeah. Ali did softball.
Good catches.
That's right. I did actually play softball. All right, Josh.
All right. Our winners are Ihor, for.
For making me come out.
That's right, as a doomer. Yeah, for telling you all about Doom. That's right.
Toss it over.
There you go. And then Ashley for asking what is consciousness and invoking the C word on our podcast.
All right. Thank you all. Thank you, Swig.
Thank you so much.